We were in chapter 11 looking at the list of people that are given there as examples of how faith exhibits itself. And we were looking in particular at how these things fit into the statement concerning first of all, that it's the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, and also the statement, where that's, but by faith it is impossible to please him, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. And we had made it down to verse 23. This is where we're going to begin. And here we have the statement by faith, Moses. When he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents, because they saw he was a proper child, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. Now, this is not the faith of Moses, but the faith of his parents, Amram and Jochebed, that's being spoken of here. And we see from here, while God's commandment is to be obedient to the authorities over us, there will be times when those authorities overstep their bounds and command you to violate God's commandments. Now, the big question for all of us is, will we act in faith under both circumstances? It is an exercise of faith to live each day under the law of the land, for it is obedience to our God who commands it. Can you hear that? It's an act of faith to obey the authorities that are over you. All right? Now, how about most of us really hate being told what to do? All right. And right now it's tax season. And some of you think you have it bad just filling out your 1040. Well, I got payroll taxes to deal with. All right. And that's a whole other ballgame. Some of you have business taxes to take care of. Fortunately, we're exempt from that, and I don't have to fill out any of those dumb forms. And 990 is terrible to fill out if you have never filled out one. And here you go. You got to dot the I's and make sure you do that. Are we to pay our taxes? Are we to faithfully pay our taxes? Yes. Are we to pay every penny of the tax that's owed? They allow us to round up or down depending on what it is, but that's their rules, right? It's following those rules, no matter how stupid they may seem to us. That is living by faith. Didn't think it was so hard to live by faith. Now, in particular, what's being talked about here is we like our freedom so much, but when we disobey the law because we think it's silly, we step out of faith because we put ourselves as the judge as to what God said is true. And what did he say? Be subject to the higher authorities. Every time we disobey, willingly disobey a law, we step out of line. We step out of God's line. We step out of following him by faith. Now, likewise, as there's, well, we haven't really experienced it that much, there are going to be times when the authorities overstep their bounds. And when they do, will we live in faith and observe God's law rather than the law of the land, no matter what the consequences for that is? We have places in the scriptures that tell us it's a shame to violate the law and have punishment come upon you. Okay? But we also have places that say that God is, I won't use the right words here, but God is proud of those that follow His law. All right? So living by faith in relationship to the law of the land is something that's a very, very important for us. Now, we come in verses 24 through 26. By faith, Moses, when he was come of years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. This is step number one for Moses that's listed here. He was reared in two different worlds. Israel, where he knew the true God, and he was also raised in Egypt. He made up his mind that he would stand with Israel and Israel's God. He knew that the reward for doing such an outwardly silly thing was greater than the earthly riches he could gain by taking his place of leadership in Egypt. Then in verse 27, it says, by faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Step two was to separate from Egypt physically. Yes, the king sought to kill him. But Moses' fear, told to us here, was not about death by the king's hand. This was Moses' outward rejection of Egypt. This flight removed Moses from helping his people. It says, therefore he endured. That's a word that means he bided his time because he saw the hand of the invisible God. Within Israel, the promise was still known that God would visit his people and take them out. They knew that. And it wasn't until the Pharaohs started to really bear down on them that they started to plead with God to fulfill his promise. But Moses was privy to this. He knew that there was a redemption coming for his people. And so while he was out in the desert for those 40 years, he had to bide his time and wait until God was ready to do that. In verse 28, through faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he that destroyed the firstborn should touch them. The third step was to teach the faith to others. Moses kept, or instituted, is what the word kept here means, the Passover. This was the first of many commands of the Lord that Moses taught the people of Israel. To have your own personal faith is of great importance. To make ourselves separate to that personal faith is essential. But we do not live unto ourselves. We have a responsibility to teach others the faith. Those three points are illustrated here. Matthew 28:19-20. Go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. He said, three important aspects of faith are given to us there. Your mental separation, your physical separation, and your outward expression, teaching of it to others. In verse 29, we pass on to Israel, where it says, by faith they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, which the Egyptians, assaying to do, were drowned. There's a comparison here. Israel were God's people. God, by faith, allowed them to go across the Red Sea on dry land. The Egyptians were not. He did not allow them the passage that Israel had. Now, all these aspects are going to show up in chapter 13, where he gets to the application to the people that he's talking to. In verse 30, by faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they were compassed about 7 days. How stupid was it to walk around those walls 7 days and blow trumpets and think that you were going to take the city by doing that? Why was it by faith? If that had been Joshua's plan, it was absolutely stupid. But it wasn't his plan. Whose plan was it? God's. And it was by faith that they followed his direction and did this utterly ridiculous thing to accomplish something that common sense tells them would never happen. And that's the difference between for us. Yes, we act in a common sense way, but common sense is not how we always live our life. We live our life by faith. Okay? And there are certain directives in here for us to do that are just not common sense. And certainly not our own sense that we want to do a particular thing. Verse 31. This one's a great one because it's not an Israelite. It's a Gentile. Okay? By faith, the harlot Rahab perished not with them that believed not, when she had received the spies with peace. Okay? Great story. You want to read it back there in Joshua? Okay. But I think the key that he's trying to sneak in here on them is it's not just for the Hebrews, it's also for the Gentile. And then the rest of the verses here. And what shall I say more? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and of Barak, and of Samson, and of Jephthah, of David also, and Samuel, of the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. They chose death rather than continuation of natural life because they understood the doctrine of the resurrection. In verse 36, and others had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn asunder, were tempted. This has the idea of mental torments. Were slain with the sword. And this particular statement has the idea of mass slaughter, where whole communities were killed because of it. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins. They wore these not as a uniform to show off. Okay? They wore these because they were the only things they could afford to put on. Being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. And these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise. So he goes back and he says, all these that I've mentioned to you here in this whole chapter, have God's stamp of approval on them. Have received a good report. Because they lived their life through faith. But they did not receive the promise. Why not? Okay. Why didn't they receive the promise? I lived what you asked me to do. I did it. But you didn't give me the promise. And the reason being, in verse 40, God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. God had a better plan. That plan was that He would send His Son. The author makes his point for his own time here. Because they had been witnesses of that very fact, that God's Son had come, that He had died, that He had risen again, that He had ascended. We see God's plan still waiting one last piece of fulfillment, Christ's return. There are still some of us who will not receive the promise in this lifetime. But the time will come when all the faithful will be made perfect or complete, as the verse says. Now, in chapter 12, verse 1, wherefore? Okay, wherefore? Seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. The witnesses here are the faithful ones that were listed for us in the previous chapter, the ones who have gone before. Especially those that are listed there. The word witness is also translated in other places martyr. of which many of those that were recorded in chapter 11 were exactly that. The author's idea here is to show that we have a great number of examples of living by faith to follow in the Scriptures. Okay? If you're not sure what it means to live by faith in a particular problem that you're having, where do you find the answer? In the Scriptures. Yep. Right there. Okay. God's given them to us for our examples so that we know how to live by faith. Since each of us has the examples for encouragement and instruction, he says to them, "Let us lay aside every weight." That word means a bulk or a mass. A fat man cannot run a race very well. How well do I know that? There was a time in college where we had a particular group I belonged to, and we signed up as a team to do different activities. One of the guys had signed up to run the 880, and he couldn't make it that day. And so if you didn't show up, you lost points for your team. And so I ran in his place. You notice I didn't sign up to run the 880. Well, we all lined up at the starting line, and we took off. Now, that's two times around that track. Okay. And so I took off running as hard as I could and got around to the starting line on the first lap. And, of course, by that time, everybody else is way over there on the other side coming around the last curve. And there's two of us dragging along here behind. About a quarter of the way around the first next turn, the other guy, he drops out. I make it halfway around that turn, and I drop out. A fat man can't run the race very well. Okay? And that's the idea that this author is giving here. Some of us are carrying around on us things that are inhibiting us from running the race well. Now, these are mostly external things that I think he's talking about here, because he comes to internal things a little bit later on. The example was that if we go back to Chapter 11, Moses' weight was being called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. That was a heavy weight on his shoulders. And it made it impossible for him to live the other life as an Israelite. Okay? He couldn't live in the two worlds. So he gave it up. The particular weight referred to by the author of his readers here, as we've been looking through this book, is the weight of going back to the temple worship. They couldn't carry around that temple worship aspect and also be free to live their new life by faith. So for us, there are things that we've dragged over from the world that are inhibiting us from being able. They just act like having a whole bunch of extra weight around your midsection here and keeping you from running that race that you need to run. Then it goes on. It says, and it's, one can get rid of the external encumbrances and yet have the internal problem slow them down. And that's the little phrase there. It says, lay aside the sin which doth so easily beset. This is the sin that always sneaks up. And the idea of besetting is that it wraps itself around your legs and trips you. All right? I don't know if you found it or not, but there's always that one sin that just pops up in your life. Pops up in your thoughts. And while you may not always succumb to it and do it, that temptation always keeps popping up. That particular sin is always kept mindful for some reason. This is like the ancient man trying to run in his long flowing robes. Okay? And of course, as he's trying to run, those things are flapping around his legs and catching him and tripping him. So what did they do? Well, if they knew they were in a particular race, they'd get rid of that big, heavy one that was on the outside. They'd lay it aside. But they still had their other one here that was still down around their legs. They would grab that and tuck it into the belt that they had around so that their legs were free to run in the race. Okay, that's what he's telling us here. That particular sin that does easily beset has to be dealt with, has to be taken care of in some way in order for you to live by faith. Another thing about the race that we run is a long one. The statement here, it is set before us, or it's laid out in front of us. Okay, it's out there. And it goes a long way. 880 is not a long way to run, but certainly is if you can't do it. I certainly hate to try to run the marathon. I probably couldn't even do it walking. Now, because of the length of the race, it must be run, it says, how? With patience. The idea in this word is two aspects to it. There's a passive endurance to it. And there's an active persistence behind it. Okay? Long distance racers, they got to get into the zone. Okay? Everything is gone around them. Their mind is set only on keeping going. And they keep going. And they keep going. And they keep going. Until the end of the race finally comes. And that's exactly what our race is like. It's a race that starts and it just keeps going. And our need as faithful runners is to keep going. Keep going. Keep going. In verse 2, it says, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. So the author here is telling me, now, if this great cloud of Old Testament witnesses is not enough for you, then take your eyes off everyone else and put them onto Jesus. The statement here, he is the author. The word means he's the chief leader He's already finished the race. He is where the race ends. Follow Him. Look on Him. If you're having troubles, look at what He did. And it says here, He is the finisher or the completer of the faith. He did not look at the present. And that's one of the things, if we're going to live by faith, that we have to start doing. We have to get our eyes off of the present and live in the past. Only got one head shape. Don't live in the past. Nothing good in the past. Nothing worthwhile dragging along with you. That's a heavy weight. Okay? Look where? To the future. Okay? And in the statement it says, who for the joy that was set before him. Okay? Now, it's not really like the proverbial carrot in front of the donkey. Okay? That he keeps trying to get that. Okay? He knew of this joy that laid ahead. And it says, if our eyes are set on our feet as we run. How many of you run that way? If your eyes are set on your feet, the present, what's going to happen to you? You're going to run off the road. You're going to hit something that you didn't see. The runner doesn't do that. The runner's eyes are out there in front of him. And so we're either going to run in the wrong direction or we're going to run into something. Now, it was because he could see the ultimate end, set down at the right hand of the throne of God, that he could endure. What did he endure? The cross. Okay? How many of you could endure the cross? Especially if you knew that that's where you had to run to. Okay? And it says he despised the shame associated with that crucifixion. What's the shame that's associated with crucifixion? Yeah. He died with the malefactors, it says. Big word that means he died with the ones that were guilty of doing the wrong thing. But he put up with that shame. He despised it. He said, I don't care about that shame. I'm going to go ahead and do it. To run the race. And he finished the race. That sat down at the right hand is typical of an understanding of finishing the race. In verse 3, for consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds. I know, the author tells us readers here, that you're constantly being bombarded by your friends and family about your faith. But look at Jesus and all the contrary statements that were made against him. And notice how he was able to endure them. Now, don't be weary and fainting in your minds or your soul. The idea of minds there is the word that we translate soul in other places, which has the whole idea of the whole part of you, your physical and your mental aspects. What were the contrary statements that they threw in Jesus' face. They looked to him. Yeah, there's one of them. You're the Son of God like you say you are. Okay. In a sense, they were calling him a liar, right? Then come down. So, prove it. Yeah.
Turn these stones to bread.
Yeah. Devil told him to do that, right? Called him a child of the devil, yeah. Yeah. We be not born of fornication, but you are. Lie, of course. But they constantly kept throwing these things up to him. And yet he was able to stay on the course that was laid out for him. In verse 4, ye have not resisted unto blood, striving against sin. So far for these Hebrews, that the letter is going to, had only been suffering verbal taunts and financial loss. They had not had to die yet. Now, that would come, but their present suffering should not be enough to make them want to turn back. Verses 5 and 6, and ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. This is a quote from Proverbs 3:11 and 12. The words translated chasten in this verse and the others that we'll see in the here mean instruction, teaching, training. They do not automatically infer physical punishment. The corollary word next to it, the word in the statement here, the word scourge, brings the idea, or it actually means flogging. The Old Testament is replete with God's example, or the examples of God instructing his people in righteousness and punishing their disobedience. Both are necessary if that father-son relationship is to exist. In verses 7 and 8, if ye endure chastening, God dealeth with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father chasteneth not? But if ye be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are ye bastards and not sons. Remember here that the professing church is made up of believers and unbelievers. The truth here lies in the fact that those who endured the chastening of God are the true sons. Those who do not endure the chastening are illegitimate and therefore not true sons. Furthermore, and you can also look at that as this is how the distinguishing can be made within a church. It says in verse 9, furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? It says, you all have lived with your earthly father, and he trained you, and you gave him respect. If this is true for the earthly, how much more should it be, or should you be under obedience to the Father of spirits? Why are children today so ill-behaved? Their earthly father has not been training them. Why are the people in the churches so ill-behaved? They're not under obedience to the Father of spirits. They ignore his instructions and go about and do things the way that they want them to be done. Verse 10, for they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure, but he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. Our fathers only trained us for a short time before we reached the age of emancipation. And only they trained us only in the things that pleased them or what they thought was the good for us. God, on the other hand, trains us for profit, literally to bring us together. The idea here being, we're here, we're there, this is that thought, and this goes here. His training is to bring all those things together into a whole, complete believer. Have you felt that in yourself? Do you see that in what's been happening to you? How you used to think this way, but after God's instruction to you, it turns you this way. And now you have a better thought pattern. How about your actions? Used to do this, but now I do this. It's because God's teaching to us brings us this way. Now, sometimes that teaching can be real tough. How many of you liked every subject that you had in school, just as an example? Were there some subjects that you just couldn't wait to get out of that room? Gym, right? Especially when they put me on the pommel horse and I swung my leg up over there and I'm hanging backwards like this with one leg up and everything else is falling off. No. Okay, gym. Okay, could be tough. Sometimes it could be physically tough on you what God puts you through. Okay? Sometimes it could be physically tough on you. Sometimes he might just have to smash you up inside of a car wreck to get your attention. Physically tough. Sometimes he could put you through some of the hardest mental trials that you've ever been through for good, as Paul puts it. And the reason is he wants to bring us all together, bring each individual into that one person that can live by faith. And so, and the reason is, why does he want us to bring us that way? The final little phrase there. That we might be partakers of his holiness. Okay. Now, the idea of the holiness here is not some existential thing. God's holiness always comes out in your actions. It's following his righteous plan for you. It's staying on that race that's been laid out in front of you until you come to the end. And that's what he desires of us. Now, he'll continue on with that, but I don't have time. And I'll see you in about 5-6 weeks and hopefully finish it then. Our Father, make us into who you want us to be. No matter where we are, may we constantly keep our minds on you and the direction that you have set us in. And may we all here today finish that race and not fall off the path and fall back into the perdition that we were once in. And we ask this in our Lord's name. Amen.